Blog Talk Radio.
Cindy's Corner, bringing you timely topics in an informative and entertaining way from all corners of the world. Starting tonight, I will be opening each segment, each episode, with an opening statement, which I will call Cindy's Points from each corner, featuring some opinions and facts from the headlines of the day. First, I'd like to update you on a segment we did last week featuring Francesco Portellis and Rachel Cohn and the idea of solutions for education, something that everyone seems very concerned about. Francesco spoke about his experience sitting in the rubber room and heading a group called UFP Solidarity. This group is made up of many educators, parents, and concerned taxpayers who question the current policies that run our education system. Many, like Portellis, as he told you, are targets for termination and penalties when they speak up against something that is going on that they don't like or deem incorrect. Here is where the problem lies. They refuse to engage in discussions with opposition or think, what have I got to lose? Similar to what Donald Trump says when he discusses the African-American vote that has been taken for granted in the Democratic Party for 50 years. Or they're afraid of voting against the machine that continues to take care of their retirement system and pensions, and afraid of either having more retaliation or any kind of activity against them that would deem harmful. So when you work with that, it becomes a problem. And many of them choose to remain silent or get upset when someone like Portellis speaks out. The same goes in many of the opt-out and anti-Common Core groups, something that Rachel Cohn spoke so strongly about. I actually heard this week from an anti-Common Core teacher complaining that Common Core is a wonderful curriculum and it makes it very easy for teachers to plan lessons, but it's the evaluation system within Common Core that is the problem, and that's where the mistake lies. Common Core is more than a test, and it's more than a curriculum. It's in each part of the teaching system, whether or not it's a public school, a private school, a charter school, or even homeschooling, because your tax dollars are paying for the supplies, the teaching guides, the preparations, and the actual lesson plan books that are used. We are not against fair and objective evaluations. Each one of us evaluate things in our everyday life. You evaluate which brands you buy, which movies you see, and where you repeat your purchases. Our education system as a whole is a problem, but if you don't want to engage in meaningful discussion, take chances, and try change, then you are actually a part of the problem and not the solution. Another corner I'd like to address is something that was just posted on Madison's, a Byline's article, a very timely issue that took place over the last couple of days. And that is the Kim Kardashian robbery during Paris Fashion Week. A lot of different information is coming out. A lot of different opinions are coming out. But I want you to think, how much should anybody post on social media? When is social media good? And when is it not so good? We do use social media. We use it as a major part of this outlet media system. And for that's good because we meet many people we wouldn't ordinarily meet who have our values or maybe have different values and they like to exchange ideas. But when does it become a problem so that someone's life could possibly be challenged or endangered? Think about that and please read the article. As I said, it was just posted and it'll be up and shared throughout the next coming days and we will learn more about that. Next, I'd like to thank everybody for their outpouring of interest in many of the recipes and the guests I've had and many of the entertaining tips that I've shared. And we will be sharing more of those. I now have an Instagram account called Cindy's Corner Radio Show, and it's on my Facebook, and you can get more information through Madison. And I'd be happy to share everything I know, everything I learn, and all the people that I am meeting to do all this kind of great food, decor, entertaining, drinks, and lifestyle trends. Because regardless of where you are, you all embrace all these topics and love them. So thank you, and we'll have plenty more of them. Some upcoming dates and events you should mark on your calendar. Next week, there will be no show, and there will be an Open Rebellion radio show instead. But on the 19th, which coincides with the last night of the debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, we are going to feature a young leadership town hall with millennials who will share some of their thoughts on this election, statewide elections, and how young people are getting involved and are not apathetic, and it should be very interesting. And on October 26th, we have a very special guest for the entire hour. We are going to have an hour-long conversation with Peter Madrigal, manager of Sir Restaurant in Los Angeles. Peter is also one of the stars of Vanderpump Rules on Bravo TV, which will be starting its fifth season in early November. We will have him for the entire hour, and we will have call-ins to speak with him directly. And we will be getting exclusive behind-the-scenes tidbits of what we can expect from Lisa and Jiggy, her dog, Jax, Katie, and the Toms. And we're going to also get to hear some surprises from Peter, including his new hairline and his work on the editorial board of an upscale men's magazine. I am also going to get him to share his famous spicy margarita recipe, which is featured in the restaurant and on the show. So keep tuned, stay in touch, and let's get started because I am thrilled about tonight's lineup. It's very exciting, and I know many of you have contacted me how exciting you are about it. Later in the show, we are going to have Rick Tyler, and both of us are going to share our thoughts on Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, last night's debate, the November elections, 2020, and the future of the Conservative Party. But first, we have a powerhouse woman and somebody who I'm really happy to say is actually giving up a lot of her time tonight because she lives in the heart of where Hurricane Matthew is about to hit and is in the middle of preparing herself and her family for safety. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Dee Velez Sutton, who will share her thoughts about Hispanic Heritage Month, the Latino vote, working on immigration reform, and also her work on education reform, especially for families of special needs students and parents. Hello, Dee, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me on tonight. I feel honored.
Well, Dee and I actually met through my book, Rubber Room Romance, because Dee is somebody who knows a lot about education as a parent, as a student, as somebody who's worked in the school, and somebody who's worked on education reform on a legislative level. So tell us a little bit about the work you have done in education.
I got started in the whole process because my son, who was on an IEP, had his services canceled, and he wasn't better. He was under a speech IEP, but that year we didn't have money for a speech pathologist, and so we canceled all the IEPs, and it got me investigating about the process. And so I filed a due process on the school, and I started researching, and from that activism, everything that I did, I got involved in taking classes and learning a little bit about IDEA, and I found out that this Individuals with Disabilities Act was something started by the Liberals, Ted Kennedy and Hillary Clinton, and it was a very unfunded mandate. Also during my investigation, I found out that they were sending the head of IDEA into other countries to explore socialized healthcare, and he wasn't doing his job. And so we had millions of dollars under the Obama administration given to that particular program, and that was basically to balance the PERS pension fund when we had an economic shortfall. So what IDEA really stood for, what it really was it was a big piggy bank for Hillary Clinton in order to carry the unions, and using the disability kids as a means to do that. What really shocks me is that I went to actually some stuff where they have through the Dyslexic Foundation classes on how to advocate. And part of the activism was that they actually had Hispanic listed as a disability. And so I was really shocked that they were telling me as a parent I had to advocate so my kids would get their IEPs implemented. But they were basically already promoting Hispanic as a disability and as a right. And my mom came from Puerto Rico, and I had an IEP as a young child. And what they did with me was they told my mom that I should just focus on English only. I was behind everybody in school, and I wasn't up with my peers. So they felt like her Spanish was so broken, and she wasn't literate in her Spanish. And I was an American citizen, and it would be better for me to be dominant in English. And so what that did was it enabled me to graduate from high school, which none of my immigrant parents have graduated from high school, not the Irish one, not the Italian one, not the Puerto Rican one. But the thing that was different from everybody else is that the people that assimilated with our society fared better, and the people who held on to their language actually stayed on the welfare system. And so I'm really glad, and I feel very thankful that somebody advised my mom well. And my son ended up going to Grinnell, and he, got his degree in finance, and so proud of him. First-time person on either side to get his college degree, so he has a degree in finance. And so from there, I was on TV back in Oregon knocking down the DREAM Act. And this is really gets me when I was on Oregonians for Immigration Reform, because one thing led to another. I actually was in testimony, and with the Oregon Democrats, I stopped the in-state tuition to illegal immigrants. My argument was I had a learning disability, and nobody gave me any special privileges. Nobody said, oh, because you're learning disabled, we're going to help you with your college or anything like that. But they actually, for a person that's a minority or for a person that just comes from out of state, they had to pay three times the tuition rates. And yet we could give the in-state tuition and actually free college to somebody coming from Mexico, and I didn't think that was fair. And actually we won. We blocked the in-state tuition, college tuition for illegal immigrants. Of course, you know, after my accident, when I was in the hospital, they got another board of people together and a different group of people, and they pushed what they needed to push through. So that victory became a loss. But it really spurred me into getting into the grassroots activism. And something that really is surprising, when it came to Florida, I heard about Hispanic Heritage Month. And I always thought that was odd, because growing up, I never thought of myself as a Hispanic American. My mom was from Puerto Rico, but my father is also Italian and Irish, and we didn't say Irish American or Italian American. And so it was kind of odd for me, because growing up in Queens, actually being born in Queens, New York, and growing up in New Jersey, nobody really talked about that. You know, we just kind of assimilated with society. And lots of people were Puerto Rican, and we didn't call ourselves Latinos, Americans. And so I had a grandfather who was an Irish cop, and there wasn't an Irish Heritage Month. But if we should have any kind of appreciation month, it should be American Heritage. I mean, we all come from somewhere to come to this great country. And gosh, I'm such a proud American, and that's what got me involved in all the activism that I got involved in, and it comes from my background.
Well, Dee, you certainly aspire. You said so much there, and you brought up the immigration reform that you're working on. And one thing I notice, and that many of our listeners notice in this season, is especially in the presidential election from both candidates, is the talk so much of certain groups being taken advantage of in one party versus another. And you happen to live in Florida, where you have people like Marco Rubio, who is in a big position and is up front and in the Republican Party. And you have other people there. You have an Alan West, who's a minority, who's a leader in the Republican Party. So where do you see and what do you hear about Hispanics in Florida? What do they feel is going on in this election?
Well, you know, what really bothers me about my own party is that people try to do what the Democrats do to kind of get along. And then I feel like, you know, our laws are there on the books and for a reason, to protect the country. And that's why I side with Donald Trump. And I'm not a racist. And one of the things that people fail to understand is that, like, back in the day, my mom came from Puerto Rico, and she partook in a program called the Fresh Air Program. And that program was started by Eleanor Roosevelt, who was a Democrat. And before it became just about fresh air, they actually took little Puerto Rican kids from New York City and put them on these farms and worked them like little slaves. And they did that because the parents worked in factories and they didn't have daycare for these kids for the summer. And so my mother, not knowing any English, was taken out of her home at 4 years old, putting into this stranger's house, couldn't communicate with her family, had her hair all cut off. And people would be outraged if they knew about that. And yet, this was a Democratic woman who goes down in fame over this program. But people never tell the truth. Like, they never tell the truth about Hillary Clinton and what IDEA really is, which is a big piggy bank for the Democrats. So, you know, one of the things that I really feel is, like, when we have a leader, whether he's Hispanic or whether he's an American, it doesn't really matter about the nationality. You have to stand on principle and you have to stand for something. And if you don't, then why are you in that leadership position?
I couldn't say it any better, and neither can many other people. Now, I'm really happy you're with us tonight. I just want to get off track a minute, because the headlines everywhere is, of course, Hurricane Matthew. What's going on in Florida in regards to Hurricane Matthew, and what kind of preparations are you doing personally, and what do you see going on around your state?
I've never really had any experiences with hurricanes before, but I remember my mom lived through, I think it was Hurricane Charlie, and it devastated Orlando years ago, and they were without water. So that's the main thing is getting enough water and just, you know, and food just in case the power goes out. But in Oregon, we would go whole weeks without power, and this never got in the media, and it never got out there. And we'd sit in the middle of the forest in the middle of the winter with a wood stove, and there would be no power or nothing for a week. And finally, after a week, I called up my Congresswoman, Darlene Hooley, who got things going. But so coming from a very rural area, I'm not worried because there's stores and there's things all around. And, not like I'm in the middle of the forest. And so I'm just praying and hoping for the best. Sometimes they play it to be worse than what it is, and it veers off, and sometimes they downplay it. So you just never know. So I'm just prepared.
When do they tell you it's going to actually hit?
They said Friday around 2 o'clock. And so the coastal regions of Florida are going to be hit a lot harder than I'm on the other side. I'm on the Gulf side. So, I mean, we still get, like, storms and stuff. So, basically, what it means is stay close to home. I got caught in a downpour one time, and around here, it's horrible. I was canvassing for Senator Jeff Brandis, and they called everybody in early to have pizza and you know, hang out. And I got so, like, gung-ho about, like, getting to all the houses that I ignored what my boss said and kept going. Well, that was a bad idea because what happened is the rains came and it was raining so hard I couldn't see, and the streets here flood really bad. So basically, you're underwater, and I felt like I could just float down the road, and I had to veer off and turn off and try to get home and try to drive in the rain. And never again will I ever be caught out when there's a storm like that. You know, when it says come in, I learned my lesson from Jeff Brandis. So,
where can my listeners learn more about you? Because you write, speak out, you do speaking engagements. Where can they find you?
Well, we're actually really wanting to get some sort of an internet media show set up, and we just finally are getting the equipment lined up and everything, because I was doing that last time, and now right before this election, I want to get back into doing that. So I'm slowly but surely getting myself there, and so we'll be posting some things out in the next few weeks, and then I'll put that over LinkedIn and Facebook, so people can kind of, you know, see my position on certain things, and I'll talk about the debates and stuff like that. I really, really love Donald Trump. I grew up in New Jersey. I actually worked in Manhattan when I was 19 years old. On the first day in the big city, I got hired at this company, Neiman Harper and Steers Corporation, and they were an advertising agency. And I remember going out after work with some of my coworkers, and we walked by Trump Towers, and people just said nothing but nice things about him. And, you know, it's ironic, you know, you're a great guy until you run for public office. And then, you know, it is what it is, you know, goes with the territory.
And what's going on in the statewide and local elections, Laura? Anything to update us on?
Well, you know, it's so ironic because people say, you know, Latino voters, and I always have to laugh because I talk to Puerto Rican people in the area and stuff like that, and so many of them support Donald Trump, and especially in Pinellas County, there's a lot more of us out there than you have any idea. And the Republican Party says we don't have any Latino voters, and so I guess they don't consider Puerto Rican Latino. And so it's interesting because I go to Zumba, and I love my Zumba classes, and it's always filled with Hispanic people, and there's just so much diversity out here. And so I think people are going to be really surprised because my Puerto Rican family, they're all supporting Donald Trump. And there's about, you know, 100 of them in this area. You know, we have a big family, and I know they're going to get out and vote. My Aunt Angie is in Orlando. You know, we're pro-life, and we're very conservative, so there's this whole misconception about Republicans being Democrat out there. And, you know, I guess maybe they might be talking about the legal immigrants, but I think once they understand the positions and they learn English and they learn about the process and stuff and what it entails, a lot of them eventually come around because my mom, back in the old days, did support Ted Kennedy. And it's so funny to see that shift. You know, they went from, you know, supporting the Democratic Party, and they're all now conservative.
See, I just wanted to end with a personal tragedy that happened in your family that you and I were talking about a lot. That really hit home because it was a little bit of the debate last night, and that was with the Syrian refugees coming here and with the terror attacks, because you live not too far from where they're on our land. So just end it with your final words with that attack, what happened, and the impact.
What concerned me is, I live in a state which, we have a wonderful governor here.
Remind everybody exactly where it was and everything.
I was up at Orlando Regional Medical Center when they had the terror attack, and I was up there with my fiance, Robin Word, and he was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's. And so we were in the hospital. He was going through a surgery to get a feeding tube put in. But a short time after that, he had passed. But we were up there, and we were on the fourth floor where I think it was the Heart Center. And from my window, I could see the planes landing on top of the roof of the hospital. And around the middle of the night, which was really crazy because I was in a sleep and I was dreaming about a terrorist attack, and I was dreaming about Mr. Bush. He was in my dream. And then I'm woken up in the middle of the night, and I'm told that there has been a terrorist attack, and that it was down the road, and that they think that there was a shooter in the building and that we're under lockdown. I mean, I was terrified. I was looking for places to hide. And, of course, they tell you to close the door. So when they come back, every time the door opens, you think, oh, is this the shooter, you know? And we had a heart patient from a Hispanic family. He just had a heart procedure done. He was trying to get up out of bed and remove all his medical devices and stuff. So, you know, a lot of the patients were very scared. It was a very intense time.
You saw a lot. You know, firsthand, you saw what a homegrown terrorist attack could be and how it impacts people. And it's probably an experience you would never forget.
No, and security has been a lot tougher since then. But, you know, we wouldn't have had this. We've had 8 years of Democratic leadership, and America is in worse shape than ever before. They had time to get this under control, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And it really needs to start with the border. We just let everybody in to this country. We really need to crack down on it. We've gotten so wanting to be politically correct that we're incorrect. And I really feel like we need some strong leadership. My father was in the Navy.
Well,
and he did 20 years.
I would love to go on with this, but we have to take a commercial break, and I would love to invite you back. So I want to leave here with the thought that you said about a strong 8 years of failure, and I want to thank you for all the work, Florida, and having you been on my show. Our audience know about it, then you could join. Going to take a commercial break right now. Thank you.
So, you're still using the hotel website with the gentleman that played Captain Kirk and Denny Crane, or the goon with the beard in the strange uniform, or the talking lawn gnome to book hotels, car rentals, bed and breakfasts, or cruises. Are you kidding me? Let me let you in on something. You're not really saving money with those. Those are the new retail. Why pay retail when you can book your travel accommodations and pay wholesale? In fact, up to 75% off of standard pricing. Snazzy Traveler is the travel equivalent of the big box wholesale members clubs. But you don't have to go and look for a parking space and wait in line to check out. You can save hundreds, even thousands of dollars on travel. And best of all, it's like having the services of concierge for just 27 cents a day. I'm serious. Snazzy Traveler has all the hotels and B&Bs you're looking for, and more besides. They have all the top car rental companies and cruise ships and tours. But if you want to save big money and get great service, there's only one way you can get the deals I'm talking about. Go to our website, MadisonCPC.com, MadisonCPC.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, and click on the Snazzy Traveler banner ad and get signed up. You'll soon discover why Inc. 500 rates Snazzy Traveler America's fastest growing travel website. Be smart. Be snazzy. Don't pay retail. Snazzy Traveler.
This is Dina Leibniz from Madison CPC Open Rebellion Radio, and we invite you, our listeners, to audition for our Halloween Bash. We are looking for musicians and comedians to appear on our October 27th show. While we want you to bring down the house, we ask that you don't bring up profanity, since we are a Christian station. If you are interested, send your demo and comic stylings to Dina Leichnitz, that is DenaLeichnitz, at MadisonCPC.com, and prepare to have a monster of a blowout.
Welcome back. Our next guest is Rick Tyler, and I have to say that out of all the guests I've had so far, I have had the most anticipation for having Rick Tyler on. I was lucky enough to meet him in Cleveland during the Republican National Convention, and I'm sure that you're going to want to hear everything going on in his life, from Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, the debates, MSNBC, the future of the Conservative Party, and what's going to happen in November. So we're really lucky to have him join us. Are you on the phone, Rick?
Cindy.
Oh,
hey,
hello?
Cindy.
Hi. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
I'm so happy because I was lucky enough to meet you and spend quality time with you at what I thought was the best party in Cleveland. And that was when Ted Cruz had his private party prior to his giving his speech, because everybody at that party, it was so engaged in being a part of a team, working together. You felt the love and the trust and respect for everybody there. And I hope you felt the same way. I mean, I saw you were speaking with various people on the Cruz team, and I just thought that was really the best party. A lot of them were just drinks and food, and just schmoozing. And this was just a little bit more. And
there's nothing like a presidential campaign.
and you should know it.
Yeah, you just go through it together, and all of us had lived together in Houston, and we all worked at the same headquarters, and we spent an awful lot of time together, and we're all focused on one mission, and so. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of bonding that occurs there. So it was a great group of people. And yeah, absolutely. At that event, we got the chance to reconnect.
Well, party.
I'm sorry, Cindy, I lost the audio for a second. Could you repeat the question?
I said, everybody is very excited to hear from you because you're such a leader. What is the future of the Conservative Party in America?
Well, look, I think one thing I realized, I'd worked for Newt Gingrich for about 14 years, and then I worked for Ted for about a year. And what I realized in all that time is leaders – don't come around very often. And I don't, I'm a little uncertain of the Republican Party or the Conservative Party future, although I know there's a lot of conservatives, and we thought that this would be the year with Ted Cruz that we would get a conservative to actually win the nomination, and that didn't happen with Donald Trump. But I'm confident the conservatives are still out there and they still hold fast to their principles and their values. And I'd like to see the conservatives not break away from the Republican Party, because I get upset when people leave the Republican Party, because when conservatives leave the Republican Party, they leave the Republican Party with people who aren't conservative. And I always think to myself, why should I leave? And so I hope the conservatives will organize and get back and get engaged with the Republican Party and find a way to sell conservatism the way Reagan did, which was, the happy warrior. There's no reason we shouldn't be happy. We have the right ideas and the right philosophy. So there's no reason we shouldn't go out there and promote those and win.
It's funny you say that, because I have been promoting through my, Facebook and my articles, the idea that we really do have to change the rules in the RNC, besides the open debate, besides the open, the open primaries, besides multiple debates, besides the 17 candidates. Do we really need debates anymore like we had in 1960, because we have such access to everybody 24/7?
I'm a fan of debates. I don't always like the way they're structured, and we also often have liberals running the debates, and it's not that, it's just they have a different worldview, so they don't often ask the questions, particularly in the primaries, that conservatives would want answered. So they're talking about a lot of issues that liberals are concerned with. They're not talking about a lot of issues that Republicans and conservatives are concerned with. So I'd like to see more conservatives moderating debates, and I'd also like to see the moderators take more of a timekeeper role and just let the candidates go back and forth. So I would probably keep the debates, but I would like to change it up a little bit.
I think everybody has that. Too many. And even last night's debate, every time, when Mike Pence wanted to bring up the email scandal, the moderator right away cut him off. But she let Tim Kaine go on and on as much as he could. I know it was a problem with that interrupting all the time, but she really did not give Pence enough time to really get through his issues that would be fair for our listeners that we want to hear, and what Democrats have to learn so that they can make a fair judgment.
I think.
What are your thoughts?
Mike Pence, I think, did himself a big favor last night, because he reminded us all that there is room for civility and humility in the political space. And even though Tim Kaine interrupted him 72 times, and even though I think you're right, the moderator I think was sort of a little bit one-sided in the way she applied, who gets to speak now. It seemed as though Tim Kaine was able to go on and interrupt, and whenever Mike Pence tried to, chime in, that she would shut him down. But he was a gentleman about it, and I think that showed through, and I think that's probably why he won the debate, is because he was civil and he was humble, and he knew his facts, and he was really terrific.
Well, I can't believe it. I thought it was really such a class act, and the fact that ABC, the fact that CBS, the fact that CNN was pushing and pushing and finally agreed that Mike Pence won. And the fact-checking was so incredible against Tim Kaine. And I have to share with you, I am a very big pro-Israel supporter. And mm-hmm. Tim Kaine was trying to say, he met in the office with people from Israel. Well, the reality of Tim Kaine's history with pro-Israel activism is that he was one of the major supporters of the Iran nuclear deal. He has collected over $200,000 from an organization called J Street, which promotes anti-Semitism and is trying to destroy Israel's economy. He was one of only 8 senators to boycott Bibi Netanyahu's speech when he spoke to last March in front of the Congress. And this summer, he refused to sign a letter to Obama that demanding extra aid to Israel that 83 out of 100 senators signed from both parties. So here was a man trying to say how pro-Israel and this great Iran deal, and everybody, including his liberal media friends, actually did the fact-checking and found him totally lying, for lack of a better word. What were some of the other highlights you saw last night?
Well, I thought it was interesting that, and I completely agree with you about Israel. Israel always has to remain an important ally of the United States. We haven't had good relationships with Israel over this last administration. I don't think we want to go for another 4 or 8 years and not having a good relationship with Israel. And you're right, Senator Kaine boycotted Bibi Netanyahu's speech, which was really sort of unprecedented that you would have a foreign leader address the Congress and people would boycott the speech. And they claimed that it was political because he was up for re-election, but when they never talked about it. See, Obama administration, a lot of his political hands were actually over in Israel trying to help defeat Bibi Netanyahu, something we shouldn't be trying to do. But I thought some interesting parts of the debate last night were, well, one thing was interesting is every time Mike Pence tried to make a good point, it wasn't just that Tim Kaine was trying to interrupt him when he was attacking the Clinton campaign. It was more when he was trying to get across a good idea. And I found that to be a little bit unseemly, but it was notable that Mike Pence took a little bit of a different posture. Well, actually a very different posture on Russia than Donald Trump did. And I think that might've eased some people's fears that Donald Trump, his campaign was being a little bit too coy and a little bit too friendly with Putin, who is not a good guy. And I think Mike Pence had it right last night.
Mm-hmm. You wrote this week that this past week was Donald Trump's worst in the entire election. Can you elaborate?
Well, look, I've been involved in many, many presidential cycles, and I'm a political observer like many, many people, and I've looked at a lot of bad weeks that politicians have, but it really was just, the breadth of the things that happened to Donald Trump's campaign last week was, the scale of it was just really remarkable. And most of it had to do with the post-debate spin. You know, Donald Trump didn't do that well in the debate against Hillary Clinton. I think most people would agree with that. He had a good first 20 minutes and then kind of ran out of steam, and she clearly won the debate. In fact, the scientific polls showed that she won the debate. But then that's okay. You know, sometimes people do have bad debates. Even Barack Obama had a bad first debate against Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney had a terrific debate in his first debate, and you recover. But Donald Trump compounded his poor performance in the first debate by getting into a Twitter war with the former Miss Universe, which he owns that pageant. And, you know, he really brought the campaign to a new low, and he really tried to discredit her. And in fact, at one point he said that, you know, that she had a nefarious past and described that she had appeared apparently in a sex tape, which nobody's been able to prove, and nobody's ever he hasn't provided any evidence of that. And then we learned today that he, in fact, has appeared in at least 3 softcore pornographic videos produced by Playboy. Now, some people might say, well, what's the big deal? Well, you could say what's the big deal and what's not the big deal, but the big deal is hypocrisy. Donald Trump accused a former Miss Universe of appearing in such a video when the fact was he appeared in 3 of them, and he would have known that. That is a very, very bad week when you're this close to the presidential, when you're close to this close to the election day.
And it's been reflected in the polls, as everyday polls, even Fox News, showing that he is now behind. You said the first debate in 2008 and
Yeah, Cindy, we're having a little trouble with your phone. And Cindy, how about you go ahead and just call back into the studio on a fresh line, and we'll take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back with Rick Tyler and with Cindy Gross.
Are you as frustrated as we are? Tired of government representatives who don't think protecting your rights is a priority? We know you're out there, patriots with a passion for restoring our constitutional republic, but you might not know how you can make a difference. Knowledge is power. James Madison said, "A people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power that knowledge gives." Our nation is in crisis. The rule of law is being usurped by the rule of the elite few. What would our founders do? They staged a rebellion. They secured for us the blessings of a republic. It's up to us to keep it. Maybe another revolution is in order, this one fought with the weapons of knowledge. Join us for Open Rebellion Thursdays at 6 p.m. Central Time.
Okay, we have Cindy Gross back on hopefully a good line.
Okay, yes. I'm sorry I got cut off, but you have one of your biggest fans on the phone with you, the director of our show, and he was going to take over some of the last couple of questions anyway, so I hope you guys were able to continue a little bit of the conversation.
I just, Cindy, I just basically ran a brief commercial break because I didn't want to cut you off if you were in the middle of a particular line of questioning, but Rick, thank you so much for joining Cindy's program. We
That'd
really appreciate it, and I appreciate the opportunity to get a little bit better acquainted with you myself. I'm curious, well, one of the things I wanted to compliment you on is a great line that I'm going to use somewhere here in, you know, the next couple of days to sort of just impress and annoy people, depending on their perspective, is your quote where you say that during every campaign there comes a moment in time when you feel the train is leaving the tracks. And to me, this has this feeling the toothpaste is out of the tube. I love that. I mean,
well, look,
just
I've been an observer for political elections for a long, long time, and sometimes you can just see that a campaign is not getting it together. And the thing with Donald Trump is we say over and over again, and a lot of people I talk to in the media, you know, is this it? Is this, you know, Donald Trump keeps saying he's going to turn the corner and that he's going to become more disciplined, he's going to ask more presidential, but over and over again he proves that he's either incapable of it or simply doesn't want to do it. And so I don't think it's actually – I a long time ago decided it wasn't going to get any better, and this is the way it was going to be. And it's unfortunate, and it makes me a little bit angry because he has, in a sense, hijacked the Republican Party, and the Republican Party is going to suffer. It shows you how ideologically weak the Republican Party has been, and he is our nominee, and he's going to squander the one opportunity that we have to get the White House back and of all things, give it to Hillary Clinton, whose policies and trustworthiness et al. Are very concerning to me. And in particular, as Donald Trump notes, is that we need Supreme Court judges. We have an 8-8, we have a 4-4 split on the court now because there's one vacancy, and the next president will fill that vacancy and likely others. And the court has not been ruling in a very conservative way over many, many decades now, and we have a chance to balance out the court and make the court conservative, but all that is going to be squandered because Donald Trump can't run a disciplined campaign. And that really makes my blood boil a little bit.
Going
no,
back
no,
before
can't.
I was cut off.
True.
Oh, I was going to ask.
No, go ahead.
So you sort of answered that you don't think he's really going to come back in the second and third debate.
No, I have very little confidence that Donald Trump can actually be and act presidential. I think that's why people, that's why I think Mike Pence got such great reviews last night, is because in a race where you have Hillary Clinton, who is always at odds with the truth, and you have Tim Kaine, who can't help himself but to interrupt 72 different times, and Donald Trump, who can't seem to maintain discipline in the course of any given day, you had Mike Pence, who was very composed, had the right tone, had the right temperament. He was a gentleman. Even when he was cut off, interrupted, and unfairly, he never complained about it, and he just plowed forward and did the best he could, and I thought he did a terrific job.
Yeah, I think conservatives and Republicans are in pretty much universal agreement that if the ticket was configured to the opposite, that Pence would be right now would be doing quite well against Hillary Clinton, and the entire picture of the campaign would look different at this point. But as it is, I have a lot of friends who are just basically in serious denial about the direction this election is headed. And one of the things that they bring up to me, which I have to correct them on, is the notion that because Mike Pence does well in a vice presidential debate, that is going to have any impact on the polling situation. And I asked them to point to me some data that indicates that a vice presidential nominee has any impact on the general election, and I've yet to have any of them take me up on that.
Yeah, historically they don't. I mean, right, because we don't remember vice presidents. We can go, even if people who can name most of the presidents who've served in that office, very few people can actually name very few of the vice presidential candidates. We just simply don't vote for vice presidential candidates. The best you can hope for is that your vice presidential candidate might have a good organization in a state where he might deliver the state for the candidate and therefore deliver the electoral votes on election day. So that would Tim Kaine would be Virginia, which is a swing state, and it seems that Tim Kaine might have some ability to deliver Virginia, and Virginia looks like it's going to go for Clinton presently. And then Governor Pence is in Indiana, but Indiana has typically gone Republican. I don't even remember the last time Indiana ever went Democrat. So in a sense, he's not really adding to the ticket there. They chose Pence because they felt like he would deliver, Midwestern conservative voters. But again, I think you're right. I think we get one news cycle out of the presidential debate, and some people's nerves might be settled that, look, Mike Pence seems like a good guy. And so they might say, I'm comfortable with him. But it really, it seldom is a game changer.
I have a question for you about the guy that we all really like and how I met you, and that's Ted Cruz. Where do you see Ted Cruz's future in this? Because he was reluctant to endorse, he then endorsed, he then, the reports where he was going to help with the second and third debate. Now you have a great Mike Pence conservative coming out last night, and all of a sudden his name is being, around today, like we discussed, in 2020. So where do you see Ted Cruz's future in all this?
Well, okay, so there's several scenarios. One is Hillary Clinton wins, and therefore we would have a group of Republicans who would try to defeat her in 2020 after her first term. The second scenario is Donald Trump wins, and he's a terrific president, and he goes on to serve two terms, in which case no one's going to challenge him. Or the third scenario is that he wins and he's a horrible president, and we have someone who would challenge him in 2020, although I think that field would be fairly narrow. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, let's just say Hillary Clinton wins, and then you'd have a group of Republicans who would want to try to beat her in 2020. I think Ted Cruz is probably the best organized for that. In other words, he has now collected a pretty stable fundraising base. He has a group of people that are loyal to him and that are organized. So he would probably start with the best base. Now, when he endorsed Donald Trump, I was not happy about that, as many people were not. I could understand if he were to explain, I'm voting for Donald Trump. There's a lot of people in that position because they don't want Hillary Clinton. So therefore they don't, and they don't think there's a qualified third party candidate who has a chance. So therefore you have to vote for Donald Trump. I get that. I can respect that. But he didn't do that. He went further to endorse him, which means to me, and I take it very seriously, when you endorse somebody, that's lending them your name and your sacred honor. And you're saying, I'm telling you to trust me that this person is someone I believe will be a good president. And so the endorsement to me is more than just saying you're going to vote for somebody. And he did that. Now, in his defense, he did promise, because he signed a document that said he would endorse the nominee, as all the candidates did. And so he's fulfilling that promise. And I can also respect that. But there are a lot of people who are going to be upset that he went to endorse Donald Trump, because Ted Cruz has built his entire political reputation on the fact that he doesn't compromise, that he is a steadfast conservative, and that he is not going to compromise his principles. And it is very difficult to argue that Donald Trump is a conservative in any regard. He's never been a conservative. He probably couldn't explain what a conservative is. He now talks about some of our issues in a way that conservatives understand or like, but he really has no, he's not steeped in those values, and he's never held those values, and he's never had any action in those values. And I judge a person not by what they say, but by what they do. The only way you can tell what someone will do in the future is by their performance in the past. And Donald Trump has virtually no deeds or no record in supporting conservative values. So I find it very difficult to go and, as Ted did, and endorse him. So Mike Pence did himself a lot of favors last night. Now, someone asked me today, a reporter asked me today, if you know, this was calculated, that Mike Pence, you know, was really running for 2020, and that's why he did so well. And I said, well, look, you know, I believe that Mike Pence wanted to do as well as he could in the campaign, and whether you think it's because he wants Donald Trump to win and therefore he would be vice president, or whether he would be a good candidate in 2020, the behavior is the same. And I think Mike Pence is actually an honorable guy, and he did sign up for the ticket, and he's been doing yeoman's work for the campaign, even though it's a very difficult campaign to work on, that my guess is that he was doing his best for Donald Trump. And so, but nevertheless, he did himself an enormous favor. People will look at him and say, you know, he understands policy. He has the right conservative policies and philosophies, and he can conduct himself against all odds in a very professional, humble, and civil way. And I think people respect him for that.
Well, speaking of working in a very humble way, I know Richard has a question for you regarding where you currently work. So, Richard, take it from here.
I'm wondering, I'm imagining in my mind what it must feel like. I mean, when you are tapped as a GOP political consultant for MSNBC, are you actually? I know that one of the incidences was where you were in a remote studio and just basically calling into the program. Have you had any in-person visits to MSNBC? And if so, what was the environment there like, and what are those folks like, you know, to work with?
Well, this may surprise you and your listeners. I've been just thrilled to be at MSNBC and the NBC News family. And while the late night shows on MSNBC, including Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell, don't share my political views, I have been nothing but welcomed and treated very well and respected at MSNBC. Now, MSNBC's daily news coverage, I think, is top-notch during the day, and I think it's very fair coverage. I've gotten to know a lot of the reporters, like Casey Hunt, like Hallie Jackson, like Katie Turr, like Kristen Welker, and I think they covered the campaigns. In fact, when I was on the campaign, the Ted Cruz campaign, I would say inarguably that MSNBC daytime coverage, not the nighttime shows, but the daytime coverage, covered our campaign more and more fairly than all the other networks. And so I've been to New York many, many times. I've met all the hosts, and I've been treated very well, graciously. We don't agree, but I get treated with respect. And in fact, since February when I signed with MSNBC, I've been on the air over 200 times. I've done 200 interviews, so they've used me a tremendous amount. And from all the shows, from Morning Joe to Chuck Todd to Lawrence O'Donnell, and you know, the other interesting thing is I actually like a challenge. I mean, I've gone on Fox and CNN, but certainly with Fox, and you know, the conservative host asks a conservative guest a question, and they all nod their head and they all say, yeah, we all agree. But you know, on MSNBC, I get tough questions, and we have a spirited back and forth, and I kind of like that. It's challenging, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, it makes sense to me. I'm frankly weary, and I have been weary of Fox News for years now. I really don't, when I think of conservatism, or at least my definition of conservatism, when I think of that network, there's not that kind of like point-to-point connection in my mind between the two things. I think conservatism, the definition of it, the broad definition of it, has shifted in some other direction, in particular, you know, with this election. But to me, I think what happens is that on November 9th, unfortunately, and a friend of mine, his older brother, has been predicting the outcome of presidential elections for, oh, at this point, probably 60 years, and he's gotten every single one of them right. And he sees Hillary Clinton. Yeah, he sees Hillary Clinton in, you know, occupying the White House on January 22nd. And so then my question is that Donald Trump's going to walk away from all this. We are not going to hear from Donald Trump supporting conservative, you know, values or policies or narratives or anything like that after the election is over. He'll wash his hands of it and move on to something else. Go back to the reality TV, whatever the case may be. And you and I and Cindy and all of our friends and, you know, people that are, you know, the grassroots people are all going to be left holding the bag. So gearing up to oppose this woman, what does that look like on January 22nd? What kind of, how do we get all of our ducks in a row? I think to me, part of it is maybe mending fences with some people that have been divided by this election.
Well, look, when we're united, we win. When we're divided, we lose. And if we can keep the House, which I think we will, I think we'll be comfortable keeping the House. I'm now feeling like we'll keep the Senate. And the reason I feel like that is because the presidential campaign so dominates the news cycle, unlike any other presidential campaign I've ever seen, that it's almost like on Lunatic Island in the middle of the ocean, and it's so disconnected from the Senate races that are out there that the Republicans are actually running some very good Senate races, and they've kept their distance from the craziness of the presidential campaign. And so I'm feeling like we may keep the House, I'm sorry, the Senate. If we don't, we'll lose it by maybe one seat, but the irony is we'll get it back in 218 because the map flips over, because now we're defending, I can't remember, something like 30-something seats, and they're defending like 10 seats. And in the next cycle, we're defending only 8 seats, and we're defending 8 seats and they're defending something close to upper 30s. I think it's 38. I'm not sure. I don't. But
yeah, and midterms have traditionally gone to the opposition party as well.
Right. So in all likelihood, if we lose the Senate, we'll win it back. Now, the thing is that we have to. I would say that Hillary Clinton, I don't believe she's an ideologue. She's not like Barack Obama. She's probably slightly, a little bit more like her husband, not entirely. But if we have people in the House and the Senate, and I remember with Newt Gingrich actually got a lot of things done with Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton actually signed a lot of things that came out of a Republican-initiated Congress, including welfare reform, including a balanced budget. And the way we did that is we won the argument with the country. And that's the way constitutional republics are actually supposed to work. You win the argument with the voters, with the people, and the people put pressure on the Congress, and Congress will act. We're not in that cycle right now. We're in the cycle where K Street, that's where all the lobbyists are camped out in Washington, they have short-circuited the process. They've said, look, we'll raise all the money for you, and we'll win your reelection. Just do what we tell you to do. And so a lot of politicians in Washington, Democrat and Republican, are bought and paid for by the lobbyists on K Street. But when the people actually engage back home, they will get the attention of the politicians over the lobbyists, but they have to engage. But the only way they're going to engage is if people make an argument to say, this is the direction we're going and this is what we want. And when the people rise up, and it always happens when in a constitutional republic, when the people have to pay attention, somebody's going to get fired. That's just the way it is. You can count on it. If they're paying attention and they feel like they have to pay attention, then somebody's going to lose their job. And so the Republicans have got to make a case to the American people where the American people put pressure back on the Congress. That's how we got welfare reform. 101 Democrats didn't want to sign welfare or vote for welfare reform. Bill Clinton didn't want to sign welfare reform. In fact, he vetoed it twice. The reason he signed it is because the American people says, you either sign welfare reform, because welfare is actually was and continues to be bad for people. And it is, if you don't sign it, we'll find someone who will. And that's what we need again. We need conservatives to make a compelling argument that conservatism is actually good for people. It actually promotes prosperity. It actually is pro-family. It's pro-life. It's all the good things that we, and it's hard to believe that we don't have a message that promotes conservatism, and that the left has so dominated the message that conservatism is terrible that people don't even want to talk about conservatism because people feel like it's a bad philosophy. Well, it's not a bad philosophy. Conservatism is about volunteerism. It's about free markets. All the free markets are voluntary actions. And so people say, you know, the private sector and free market. Free market is meaning I get to choose with my dollars what I want to spend. So if I don't want to buy a particular product or a service, I don't have to. It's all voluntary. Except for Obamacare, where you're forced to buy an insurance policy that you don't want. And look what's happened to Obamacare. That's what happens when you don't have a free market. But people there's nobody in Washington that is even capable of talking about how the free market has made 4% of the world's population the wealthiest society in all of human history. And it's because of free markets, and it's because of freedom. And yet we don't have people who understand how to articulate those arguments, and we need to be able to do that. And when we do that, people will form a parade. And, you know, politicians do with a parade. They jump in front of it. They don't organize it, but they jump in front of it and claim to lead it. And
that's right.
And that's fine with us.
That's a great way to say this has been a wonderful – actually 45 minutes with you, and a great way to say thank you, and we can listen to you forever. I mean, it's just so informative and entertaining, and we're just so happy you were able to join us tonight, and we hope to have you on again. So everybody, great. You can find Rick Tyler on MSNBC. You could follow him. Where else could they find you? Where do you want people to look for you?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Rick W. Tyler. and you can find me on Facebook under Rick W. Tyler.
I just want to close with a personal story that you don't even know that it just fit in with the whole MSNBC story. First of all, I happen to agree with you because I've gone to the studios, and MSNBC does have the nicest studios. They're the most organized, friendly. Their security is great, so they really are professional. When you said that, you really, I totally agree with you from the few times I was there. And even in Cleveland, their booth was amazing and so easy and coordinated. And we met at the Ted Cruz private party, and that night he gave the speech that the New York delegation did boo, and I being a part of it, the New York delegation, and being someone on Ted's side was not overly happy. And I went, and I had pictures of you on TV that night at the end because I couldn't stay for the whole, you know, everybody booing our Ted Cruz there. So you really helped. A few highlights for me in Cleveland. You helped tonight with my audience, and I really thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to talk to conservatives. It's also wonderful to be on MSNBC where I get to talk a conservative message to liberals.
And we look forward to seeing you there even after the election because it's a discussion that has to go on way past this election. So thank you again.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thanks, Rick. Take care.
Take care.
You bet.
Again, listeners, I want to remind you that there will be no Cindy Squana next week, but on the 19th, we're having our town hall with young leadership right before the last presidential debate, so that should be very interesting to hear what the young people, the millennials, are saying right before Donald Trump and Hillary take the stage and debate for one last time. And again, exclusive to Cindy's Corner's listeners, on October 26th, you're going to have a preview of Season 5 of Vanderpump Rules Madrigal, manager of Sir. You can find me on Facebook. You could find Cindy's Corner Radio Show on Instagram. You could follow me through Madison's, and my articles are printed there as well. Thank you for a wonderful night, and I hope you enjoyed as much as I did.